don't usually record that because it sounds like 14 people all saying this different. So we're going to get started. I'll do what we did before. I'll go ahead and share my slides for everybody. Share screen. And share screen. And we are at the point where we're talking about finding Christ in the average man. We've gone through finding Christ in the church, in the priest, in the saints, in the sinners, and now we're finding Christ in the average man. There's George is coming on now. Okay. So where do you find Christ in the average man? And Christ said, as long as you do it to one of these, the least of my brethren, you do it to me. And so he's pretty much saying, I'm in all my creation. You know, as I was praying the fiat to the Eternal Father the other day, it struck me that the one part of me that is going to be eternal, he created. And so I belong to him. You know, I'm his creation. And he created all of us because he loves us. And he wants to share himself with us. And that thought really was kind of very powerful to me as I was saying that prayer. So he's going to be in the average person. So everybody you meet, everybody that comes into your life, you know, God created their soul. And so he loves them just like he loves you. And so we have to keep that in mind. Sometimes you meet somebody and they kind of, they're nasty, you know. But you don't pay attention to that because God loves them just as much as he loves anybody else. So he wants them to learn how to love. Sometimes they've had really bad things happen in their lives, makes them kind of nasty. But you just don't hold that against them. You just try to treat them, you know, kindly if you can. You have to try to hit you or something like that, then you duck out of the way, you know, just sit there.
I can't explain this because I can't remember the book that I read a while ago, but I have an idea in my head.
Oh, that's dangerous.
So embarrassing. You don't remember all the details, right? I read somewhere that, which I have the book, that God is present in everybody because
right.
I can't remember the word the church used, because he created everybody. And where what he created, his presence is there. But there's something different. Like, he's not in everybody the same. It's like when you receive
right.
communion. He's physically present. You know what I mean? There's a difference. They said he's in everything in creation.
Yeah.
But the people that don't know him, he's still there because he created them. But it's different than those who are following him and living in union with him.
Right.
But I can't think how...
Well, Jesus talks. Yeah, Jesus talks about that in the Gospels.
Yeah.
You know, first of all, if you recall, when we went through the Gospel of John, Jesus says that if any man loves me, he will keep my word, and the Father will love him, and we will come and make our dwelling in him. So, if you love Jesus, it means you pay attention to what he said. You follow his word, and if you do that, then the indwelling Trinity, you know, resides in your soul. So you have that. But he also says that people who are lukewarm, it's hard for him to reach them. So he's there as part of the creation, but it's really hard for him to do anything with you. And then he talks about it in the book of Revelation, if you're lukewarm, he's going to vomit you out of his mouth because he can't stand. He wants you either cold or hot.
That's right.
If you're hot, it means you're really in love with him. If you're cold, it means you're thinking about him. You're just rejecting him. But as long as you're thinking about him, he can then work with you and try to convert you and turn you around, you know?
Most people are lukewarm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I'm afraid.
Yeah. So, you know, you see those kind of things. And so when you look at the average man, like we're going to start doing today, you see a whole spectrum. You see people that love God. You see people that are struggling to find God. You know, Jesus told us in the Gospels, you know, seeking you will find, knocking it shall be open to you. And so he's always knocking on the door of your soul, say, let me in. And you have to open that door and let him in.
And you can see, I don't want to sound like this is judging because it's far from it, but if you're with people or priests, you sense the presence of God.
Oh, yeah.
And you sense. Yeah. Not everybody. You don't get that sense with everybody.
Yeah. Mary Beth had that experience when we went up to Emmitsburg for a Marian conference, and Mary Ellen Lucas was there, mm-hmm. and she was giving a talk, and the priest that was her ministry partner was there, Father Don Renfred, and phenomenal priest. And Mary Beth said, the first time I met him, it was like meeting Jesus himself. Mm-hmm. You know, he just had this presence about him that he just knew, you know. And so there are people like that.
Yeah.
There are people like that, you know. Padre Pio. Can you imagine meeting him? You know? So, I mean, there are people that are very close to God, and you kind of sense it when you meet them.
Yeah.
And some people are far away, and you wonder, well, what do they really devote their time to? Mm-hmm. Everything else but God. And then there are people that are struggling. They're trying to find him. And maybe that's somebody you could help. Mm-hmm. You know, maybe they're... Maybe they'll say something or ask a question or something that gives you an open door to where you could actually say something to say, you know, but you don't pound them over the head with it, you know. You kind of take it easy, but kind of lead them gently and point them, you know. Because the Holy Spirit's has a planned path for every single person to lead them to heaven. You know, he knows what his path for you should be. And it's just a question of finding that path. You know, every one of us has a different path. That's why we have spiritual directors, you know, to help us find what that path is and then try to stay on that path. And that's an important thing, you know. So that's enough preaching. Okay, so now we'll go Christ and the Average Man. So now, Father Benson says, but Christ has even more strange disguises than any of these. So he's calling them disguises because we're all so different, right? And that which is perhaps more strange than all is that which he indicates to us when he tells us that not merely this or that man in particular, but the average man or neighbor is his representative and vicar on earth as fully, though in wholly another sense, as any priest or pontiff. So he's, you know, he's got the whole parable of the good Samaritan, the good neighbor. You know, he says, who is my neighbor? And then Jesus goes off into this parable about the good Samaritan. So he said he reveals this to us in Matthew 25:31, where he describes his own return to judge mankind. On the one hand stand the saved, and on the other, the lost, the sheep and the goats. I always got upset with that because I like goats. I used to have dairy goats. And when he says the sheep are over here, they're mine, and the goats are going to go to hell, I like goats, you know. I like my goats. They're good. They give me a lot of good goat milk, and we make good goat cheese and stuff. And I always got upset with that particular one. But he says, on one hand of the saved, the other hand of the lost. And the only reason he actually assigns in this particular discourse, you know, one or the other, for that eternal separation between the two companies is that those in the first have ministered to him in their neighbor, and those in the second failed to so minister. Because in that parable, he says, whatever you did to these, you know, you did also to me. So if you don't help somebody, it's like not helping Jesus. Mother Teresa lived that perfectly when she was around, because, you know, she would go pick up people that are dying and everything else and starving to death, and she'd, a little bitty tiny squirt, and she'd pick them up and carry them back to her monastery, and she'd bathe them and feed them and put them in bed and all. And somebody says, well, how can you do that with this person? They're full of sores and everything. And she said, I'm not doing it for them. To me, that's not that person, that's Christ. I'm doing it for Christ, because he's in that person. He's in that terrible state. And she said, I do it because I want every one of them to know before they die, because they're going to die. They're just so far gone. Before they die, I want them to know that at least one person loved them. That's a beautiful thing to say, you know? It's a really beautiful way to live. So she was an amazing woman.
I always had
have a dilemma when I see people asking for money.
What?
I always have a dilemma when I see people asking for money.
Yeah.
And I'm like, should I give it? I go through it every single time.
Yeah.
I don't know what the right answer is.
Because some of them make a lot of money.
Yeah.
Like, well, Father Gould used to say, just tell them to go to St. Vincent de Paul. That's what they're there for.
But I mean, if you're standing outside your car, from Wegmans or something, you're like, here I am getting these groceries.
I know.
But there are a lot of those that hop into their Cadillac and go home, you know? So, you never know, you know? There's so many agencies. There's so many agencies around to help people. There's no reason for anybody to be standing on the corner like that, you know? When I was living in Stafford, when I was at St. William of York, we had a very active St. Vincent de Paul group. And over 80% of the people that they would help were not parishioners. They were people that the county would send to us because they didn't have the means to help those people. And so they would send them to St. Vincent de Paul. And it was a lady there that ran St. Vincent de Paul that had this amazing talent to be able to tell when somebody's trying to scam her when they came in. In 2 minutes, man, she had them figured out. I never could figure out how she did it. She had this sixth sense about what was going on, you know. It was just incredible to watch. But, you know, people, there are places like that around. If people need help, you know, people say, well, I'm homeless and all that kind of stuff. Yeah, well, go to somewhere that can help you. Don't just stand on the corner, you know, asking for handouts. There are agencies around that are designed to help you. Some are in the county, and some of the churches. They've got these little churches all over the place that take care of people and help them. And they have food pantries and
people
kitchens.
Come into the pregnancy center, and they just make the rounds of all the places.
Yeah.
They just go from one to another. A lot of what they do is just handing out.
Yeah.
And it's a little, you have to be careful not to get hardened, because you still want to help them.
Sure.
You want them to have their baby.
Yeah. So Father Benson says, immediately we are puzzled by the apparent ignorance, it would seem genuine and sincere ignorance, of both one class and the other as to the merit or demerit of their lives. Both alike deprecate the sentence of acquittal and condemnation respectively. Lord, when did we see you hungry or thirsty, etc., etc.? We have never knowingly served you, says one. We have never knowingly neglected you, says the other. In answer, the Lord repeats the fact that in serving or neglecting their neighbors, they have respectively served or neglected himself. Yet he does not explain how actions done in ignorance can either merit or demerit in his sight. That's an interesting statement. He never explains how, when you do something in ignorance, you know, this merit or demerit happens in his sight. He says, but Father Ben says, but the explanation is not so difficult. It is that the ignorance is not complete, for it is a universal fact of experience that we all feel an instinctive drawing toward our neighbor, which we cannot reject without a sense of moral guilt. No man ever yet has lived a wholly selfish life from the beginning. No man has ever yet deliberately refused to love his neighbor or to deny the brotherhood of man without a consciousness, at some period at least, that he is outraging his highest instincts. So you have a natural tendency to want to help people. And that's what draws you to do this when you see somebody in need. The hard part, I think, is when you come to the tough love thing. You know, when you encounter somebody who you know is a drug addict or an alcoholic or something like that, and they're asking for money, and you know what they're going to use it for, you know, it's better to say, well, come on over to McDonald's and I'll buy you a meal. And a lot of them might do that, you know? But a lot of them are going to say, no, I just want the money, because they want to go buy drugs or booze or something like that. So sometimes it takes a little bit of a intuition to be able to sort through that kind of stuff. So sometimes it's better not to give money, but to give them what they need. To give them, you know, food. Or sometimes a guy says, I'm out of work. It says, if you got work they can do, maybe around your place, maybe they could come do that if they have the right kind of skills. you might need him to build a doghouse or something, you know, for your dog. I mean, whatever, you know, who knows? But, I mean, I tried to build a doghouse once, my dog wouldn't even get in it. And it fell down 2 weeks later. So you wouldn't ask me to build your doghouse. My son could build you a really good doghouse. But
if you go to Costco, on every single corner, there'll be someone standing there begging for money.
Yeah, oh yeah.
If you get there about 5 o'clock, you'll see the shift change. Another group of guys comes out to catch the rest of the night.
Yeah. Yep.
It's
amazing.
It's a money-making proposition.
Yep.
It's not something they really need.
Yep.
But if you give to a good foundation,
yeah, that helps.
That's a better way to give you money.
Well, they're all set up to do that. You know, it's always best to use something that's already organized and set up to help.
Yeah.
Because they can help so many more because of that organization.
They can legitimately help.
Yeah. And they get a lot of donations and stuff to use to help with. So Father Benson says, Christians know that the second great commandment draws its force from the first. Love God and then love your neighbor. It is perfectly certain that though some men fail to feel the force of the first, no man has ever yet, without a sense of guilt, totally rejected the second. For Christ is the light that enlightens every man. It's actually the voice of the eternal word that pleads in the voice of conscience. In rejecting, therefore, the claims of his neighbor, a man is rejecting the claims of the Son of Man. And so you have to, you know, help your neighbor when you can. But you don't want to make the neighbor totally dependent on you either.
Right.
You know, you want people to kind of fend for themselves to the extent they can. So he says, Pilate was not condemned for not knowing the articles of the Nicene Creed and for not identifying the prisoner brought before him. He was condemned because he rejected the claims of justice and of the right of an innocent man to be acquitted. He outraged incarnate truth because he outraged justice. Interesting statement. Here then is the undeniable fact. The man who does not keep the second commandment cannot even implicitly be keeping the first. That's an interesting statement. The man who rejects Christ in man cannot accept Christ in God. St. John, in one of his letters, says basically that same thing. He says anyone who says he loves God but hates his neighbor is a liar. You know, because God is in your neighbor. It's a lot of truth to that. So Father Benson says, it is not so easy, however, to recognize Christ in the average man any more than it is easy to recognize the divine will and guidance in humdrum circumstances. How is it possible for the unique to disguise himself under the ordinary, for the fairest of the children of men to hide himself under the merely unattractive, to be concealed beneath the average? Yet if the love of our neighbor means anything, it means exactly this: Christ in the heart of every man who thinks of me, Christ in the mouth of every man who speaks to me, Christ in every eye that sees me, Christ in every ear that hears me. And then he gets kind of funny. He says, the husband has to see Christ in the frivolous wife who spends half her fortune on and all her energies in the emptiest social ambition. So he must have met a lot of people that were in that kind of a state. The wife has to see Christ in the husband who has no idea in the world beyond his business on weekdays and his recreation on Sunday. The Benedictine has to see in every guest that comes to the monastery no one less than his own admirable Lord and Master. In our neighbor and in the average plane in which he and we move, we have to find him who inhabits eternity, or we cannot claim to know him as he is. So he's apparently met a lot of interesting people as a, in his life as a priest. The frivolous wives and the husbands that don't pay attention, you know. All this kind of stuff. My wife teased me one day when I got my hearing aid. She said, "I bet you got one that has the ability to tune out the frequency of my voice."
Very funny.
So she was laughing about that. But you know, he says we got people that do all kind of stuff like that. You know, people do all kind of crazy things. And I used to like Saturday mornings. Sometimes at Stanford, I'd go down at 6:10, and I'd see these cars flying by with these young women going to yard sales in the morning, you know, and they got a cigarette in one hand and a map in the other hand, trying to steer their cars, you know, they're flying down a road. How they managed not to get into a wreck, I'll never know, you know, but they're just flying down a road doing their thing, you know, going to those yard sales. Gotta go get that piece of junk that somebody else doesn't want, you know. And it was just kind of funny. But God's in them too.
Yeah.
You know? I was going out, I was on my car 17 the other day, and I got almost all the way to 95. I was going to Costco. Got almost all the way to 95. I was just a little ways before 95. And all of a sudden, these four or five cars just kind of went all banged into each other.
Oh, no.
It was right in front of me. I guess one was trying to change to sneak in to go on to 95 or something. Anyway, they all just got boom, 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 right in front of them, you know. And I just barely missed the one right in front of me. I slammed on the brakes and swerved to the right. I must have missed it by 2 inches. And the car right ahead of me did the same thing. A young girl, she pulled off to the right. I just kind of followed her. And so everybody came to a stop. There were parts of cars all over the highway, you know. And she got out of a car and came back. And she said, "Are you okay?" I said, "Yeah, I didn't hit anything. I just got really lucky." I said, "Now, how are we going to get out of this mess?" Because there was no way to move forward, you know. And she said, she looked around and she said, "Well, there's debris all over the highway here, but if you back up enough, we can probably go around it, you know."
Mm-hmm.
And I looked in the back and all the traffic was stopped at the back light. There was nobody in there. So we had a perfectly clear path to back up and go around, you know. So, you know, you got an angel is there all the time to help you, you know. So I backed up and went around. She backed up, went around. And everybody else waited for the police to come, you know. But I mean, it looked like playing bumper cars, you know. And there were big pieces of car, not just a little glass or something. I mean, there were big chunks of car all over the place. And I mean, they just went boom, all converged at the same time. It was really terrible.
Do you know if anybody was hurt?
I don't think so. But I don't know, because when I came back, because I wasn't there that long, but I came back, it was all gone. There were no ambulances or anything else, so no investigation going on or anything like that. So, but it was something. But you find people all kind of ways. That's not how you want to find somebody, if you can help it. You know, you want to find them in a different way. So Father Benson says, to do this perfectly and consistently is sanctity. So if you want to be a saint, you do this perfectly and consistently. You always love your neighbor, love God, love your neighbor, all that kind of stuff. To find him here is to find him everywhere. If we find him here, how much more easily shall we find him in the saint, the sinner, the priest, the church, and the Blessed Sacrament? And there is no shortcut to sanctity. That's an important statement. There is no shortcut to sanctity. Every day you should pray for God to sanctify your soul, just like he told us in Divine Mercy. I'm the only one who can sanctify your soul. But you should ask him to do so and then give you the grace to do what you have to do so that he can sanctify your soul. You got to disposition your soul to be sanctified. But he says there's no shortcut to sanctity. You earn your sainthood by serving others, by helping others, by loving God and helping others. I got another typo. Or. There. Oops. Fourth. Yeah. I'll save that. Two considerations are worth remarking. One, we have to remind ourselves constantly of the duty and to remain discontented with ourselves until we are at least another typo. I keep finding typos as I'm going through this. Why didn't I find them when I was writing it? And to remain discontented with ourselves until we are at least attempting to practice it. So it's something you have to consciously do. And you got to go out of your way to do it, you know. So you try to serve your neighbor as best you can. Continually and persistently, we have to test our progress by practical results. I find it easier and easier to worship Christ in the tabernacle. Do I therefore find it easier and easier to serve Christ in my neighbor? If not, I am making no real progress at all. If you spend all your time in front of the Blessed Sacrament, but you don't ever serve your neighbor, you're not really making progress. I am not advancing along the whole line. I am pushing forward one department of my life at the expense of all the rest. And that's not what he calls us to do, right? I am not developing my friendship with Christ. I am developing rather my own conception of his friendship. I am not finding him as he desires to be found. A lot of truth to that.
Well, you could say the same. Not everyone who says, Lord, Lord, will go into the kingdom of heaven.
Exactly. But those who do the will of my Father. Yeah. And what is the will of my Father? Love God, love your neighbor. Right? Just like Jesus said. So Father Benson N. says, a second aid to this recognition of Christ lies in an increase of self-knowledge. My supreme difficulty is the merely superficial and imaginative difficulty of realizing how it is possible to discern the unique beneath the disguise of the average. As I learn to know myself better and learn, therefore, how very average I myself am, and at the same time discover that Christ still bears with me, tolerates me, and dwells within me, it becomes easier for me to realize that Christ is also in my neighbor. There's a lot of truth to that statement. You know, Teresa of Avila tells us we should always go back to self-knowledge, humility and self-knowledge all the time. And that self-knowledge is not necessarily comparing yourself to other people, but it's comparing yourself to Christ. So how Christ-like do I act when I'm dealing with my neighbor? You know, do I treat my neighbor the way Christ would?
Trouble is, everybody thinks they're doing that.
Well, a lot of people don't, because just because they're selfish.
Yeah, but they, you know, a lot of them think they aren't.
But a lot of people think they are. But mm-hmm. You know, so you still have to. You have to really look at yourself honestly. And, you know, you say, would Christ want me to help this person? And sometimes all they're looking for is advice. They're not all looking for handouts, you know. Sometimes they're troubled. They just need a shoulder to cry on. They just need advice. Need a hug, you know. A hug can do a lot of good for a lot of people. And people don't do that with this pandemic going around. But sometimes you forget the pandemic and give them a hug and then trust God to protect you, right?
Yeah.
So.
Kind of think of it back when you used to have the bracelets that say, what would Jesus do?
Uh-huh. Yeah.
There was a book, too. There was some book that said it had, besides the Bible, which is the most read and published book, they said, this book, what would Jesus do? Can't remember the author, but it was amazing.
Yeah.
A little book. Small book.
Yeah,
what
a little
would
book.
Jesus do?
Yeah. There's another one similar to that, written by St. Maximilian Kolbe, called Aim Higher. And it's a little small book, but it's, you know, taking yourself beyond the average and trying to aim higher. It's a little paperback. It's really good. In the very beginning of that book, he talks about prayer, you know, because if you're going to aim higher to reach God, prayer's got to be an important part of your journey. He says it was very, very difficult for him to pray the Our Father. Because when he start to pray the Our Father, he'd say, Our Father, and he couldn't get past that. He said it just blew his mind to think that God was his father, that he was a child of God. And he just would just contemplate that, you know, for hours and never could finish the prayer. But it's that, and that has a lot to do with everything Father Benson's talking about here. Because if you think of yourself as a child of God, then how would God expect his child to act? How do you expect your child to act? You know, when your child is out playing with other kids, how do you expect your child to act? And then think about how God expects you to act with all of his other children, as diverse as they are. Yeah. You got to really think about that. It's important. So he says you got to have an increase in self-knowledge. My supreme difficulty is the merely superficial and imaginative difficulty of realizing how it is impossible to discern the unique beneath the disguise of the average. You know, we just said that. That's an important thing to remember. How do you find the unique God, the one and only, hidden in just the average person that you meet? As I learn to know myself better and learn, therefore, how very average I am, I discover that Christ still bears up with me. You know, we talked about that. As I penetrate deeper and deeper by self-knowledge into the strata of my own character, learning how self-love permeates the whole, how little zeal there is for God's glory, and what an immensity of zeal for my own, how my best actions are poisoned by the worst motives. And yet Christ still condescends to tabernacle beneath it all, to shine in a heart so cloudy as mine. It becomes increasingly easy for me to understand that he can lie hid beneath that exterior of my neighbor whom I find so apathetic, but of whose unworthiness I can never be so certain as I am of my own. Having found Christ in ourself, go out and find him in your neighbor too. Now, how do you do that with that he just talked about? As I penetrate deeper and deeper by self-knowledge, you learn how your own self-love permeates everything you do, how little zeal you have for God's glory. Yeah.
Well, you could think, who's the center of your life? Is it God or me? And when it's God, you don't think of me as much.
Yeah.
And you do his stuff.
Yeah.
Selfishness.
Right?
It's hard to get over your own selfishness.
Yeah. And so there's a lot here that is really telling you beneath the surface that every day you should do an examination. You should examine your life. You know, when you go to bed at night, before you go to sleep, talk to God and ask God, you know, how did I do today? Is there something that I did that you really didn't like, that you were shaking your finger at me about? Or is there something I should have done that you wanted me to do that I decided I didn't want to do just because I'm selfish and didn't want to put out the effort? You know, so you go down, you look at your life and you say, did I do something really good today? You know, somebody was hungry. I took them to the restaurant. I got them a meal and they were very happy and thankful. Yeah, good. You know, chalk went up for Jimbo or whatever, you know, or Susie or, you know, whatever.
I think it's harder as you get older and you don't have kids to distract you anymore.
Yeah.
You just find yourself thinking about yourself all the time.
Yeah.
It's real boring.
Well, what you ought to be thinking about is your growth, your spiritual growth. You know, if you just think about where you are, and it's kind of boring. But if you think about yourself and say, what can I do tomorrow to increase my spiritual life and make it better than it was today, so that I can grow? Because no matter how old you are, you want to keep growing spiritually. I'll be 82 on the 25th of August. I'm still growing, I hope. I still think of myself as a child of God, you know? And so I want to keep growing. until he says, okay, time to go home.
You know what I found? It's strange. You can always learn from everything that's happening in your life. But when my husband died, I said, you know, it's you and me, Lord. It's just you and me. And I found myself talking to Jesus more out loud. Mm-hmm. And I thought, too, I'm at this stage. I can't be running around. I got the Carmelite meeting. That's enough once a month. I can't be running to this, that. I used to do a lot of stuff. And I said, but you know, the Lord gives you inspirations. And I said, now it's like I'm driven to pray for souls. Mm-hmm. We're at the Chaplet of Mercy. And yeah. I said, you're giving me all the time in the world besides what I do,
right.
You know, during the day.
That's our job.
So pray more. That's it. I have a dear friend, 93. She's laid up in a nursing home in Florida. Can't get out of bed now. And she said, I just pray. Mm-hmm. I said, well, that's mm-hmm. all God wants you to do. I mean, you can't do the impossible.
That's right.
You know, just where you are, do what you can do there. And I think when we get older, it's more time to pray.
Mm-hmm.
I don't mean sitting down and reading book after book, but you know, you can grab, walking with the Chaplet mm-hmm. of Mercy or the Rosary. So that's what I find.
Yeah.
More of that stuff. Could always be more.
Sure.
You know, could always be more.
Yeah, could always be more.
Yeah.
I remember when I was a kid, I used to see women all the time. Walking down the street, going to the grocery store, or something, because we had little neighborhood groceries, you know.
Yeah.
When I was a kid, that was when the big supermarkets started to come, and all the neighbors got mad because they were running all the little grocery stores out of business and everything, you know. But anyway, but I see these women walking down the street, and they're saying their rosary.
Yeah.
They'd be kidding. They had no problem, you know. They weren't embarrassed by it or anything like that. People today would be embarrassed,
that's right.
I think, to have somebody see them saying their rosary. You know, but they weren't. They just walking down the street saying a rosary.
In New Orleans.
And in the summertime, they have the little umbrella to protect from the shade. Walk under the tree and the mockingbirds sit in the umbrella. They don't even know it, you know. So,
I mean, it's better than walking with the cell phone. That's all you see.
That's right.
Is it right? Yeah, nuts.
That's right.
Yeah.
But to go find yourself, you know, the idea that how your best actions are poisoned by the worst motives. That's something he says here. And yet Christ still condescends to tabernacle in you. You know, St. Paul tells us, don't you realize that you are the temple of the Holy Spirit? So the idea that he's willing to do that, can't you give some credence to other people that he's also in? You know, think about that. So when you meet other people, you're meeting Christ in one way or the other. You're not just meeting them. Because the eternal part of them is a creation of God. So it's something to think about. So we're going to next move on to Christ in the Sufferer. And a lot of us have met a lot of people suffering, so we can relate, I think, to this a lot. Christ and the Sufferer. And St. Paul says in Colossians, I fill up those things that are wanting in the sufferings of Christ. I heard somebody get mad when they read that one time and said, how can you add anything to the suffering of Christ? Well, Christ was just limited, and he was a man, you know. But there was just so much suffering he could do for us. He did everything he possibly could for us, but he didn't suffer everything. He didn't have cancer. He didn't have blindness. You know, he didn't have cataracts. He wasn't lame. So a lot of things that we suffer that he did not. And so St. Paul says, just offer that up. Ask God to add that to the sufferings of Christ. And why would he do that? Why would you do that? Why would you take anything, any suffering you have, and ask Christ to join it to his suffering?
So that you can enter into his redeeming redemption.
Exactly. Because mm-hmm. he only suffered for one purpose, to redeem us. If you join your suffering to his, he's allowing you to participate in his redemptive suffering. And that's a tremendous privilege mm-hmm. that, you know, we have. And so if I get sick and I have some bad disease, if all I do is complain about it, all I have is suffering. But if I can ask God to unite my suffering to his, I'm helping redeem other people. And that's, you know, a real privilege that he gives us.
It's a real hard concept.
It's a hard concept.
I think a lot of people don't understand.
Yeah.
I really didn't understand it for years. Like when people would say, just offer it up.
Yeah.
Offer what up? What do you mean?
Yeah.
What are you talking about?
My mama told us that all the time. Offer it up, yeah.
Did you go to Catholic school?
No.
The nuns told us in kindergarten, you offer it up. We grew up. Offer it up.
That's right.
Yeah. And I have some herniated discs in my lower back, my lumbar spine, and they're pushing against the sciatic nerve, and it really hurts. Sometimes when I get up in the morning out of bed, I can't make it to the bathroom. I got to stop and lean on a chair or something for a little while before I can do it. As I walk around a little bit, it kind of oils it. You know, it's like putting grease in it, like the Tin Man in the Wizard of Oz. You know, you got to kind of oil the joints before they'll move right. Then I can move around. But getting started in the morning is sometimes kind of tough. So you just offer that up, you know?
I got to tell you something. God has a sense of humor. We know it's kind of embarrassing, but anyway, I wound up with a burning tongue and a burning mouth, and I have it. And I eat, it gets worse, you know? It's like sandpaper and burning and everything. So yesterday it hit me, because I'm always thinking of funny things, and I said, oh, Jesus, I know why I have this too. For all the times I was uncharitable, for all the times maybe I said some comment I should, I said, this is my little purgatory on earth. I had to laugh.
Carol, you know? But you're better now, right? Since you took that medicine, you're better.
A little.
Yeah. That's it. Could be worse. Yeah. Could be worse, right?
Yep. So Father Benson says, the problem stands at the heart of every attempt to solve the riddle of the universe. The question as to why pain is the inseparable accompaniment of life. We see it crying for a solution in every innocent child that suffers in his body, in every anxious heart torn by sympathy or by the result of crimes for which it is not responsible, and above all, another typo. Man, I must have been really not paying attention to what I was doing when I did this. And above all, in every burdened and darkened soul that believes that she has mortality and irreparably offended a God whom she has always striven to serve. It is not the direct and evident consequence of personal sin to the sinner which we find difficult. It is when a child who is incapable of learning a moral lesson suffers for a sin which he cannot even understand. But when a naturally sweet character is maddened and embittered by a pain which he cannot see that he has deserved, when sorrow is borne by souls who seem to have a claim on joy, while on the other hand we see the wicked highly exalted, it is then that we are bewildered. Yeah, what was that book that I think Father Groeschel wrote? Why Bad Things Happen to Good People? That's kind of what he's talking about here, you know. We see the wicked, the gangsters, get very wealthy and have everything, and they get exalted and all this kind of stuff, and the other people are, you know, struggling to get along. You don't worry about that. You know, you don't get envious of somebody because they have a big, beautiful house. You get envious of somebody, not really envious, but just admire somebody that you see is closer to God, regardless of how rich they are, because you know where they're going, and you want to get there too. So you try to imitate them. You know, you try to imitate saints. When I went to Medjugorje, it's kind of struck me. I was there in 1995, and when I got there, you know, you always have these plans when you're going to go into that kind of a place, right? You have all these plans, what you're going to do. Well, none of those things worked out. We were there over Easter, and my plan was to spend a Good Friday night up on Mount Kruševac. Well, it rained cats and dogs that day, so, you know, there was no way I could do that, you know. And one of the things we were going to do was go visit Father Jozef. And so our whole group, you know, was getting ready to go see Father Yozo, I didn't go. And I stayed behind. I spent the whole day in the Adoration Chapel before the Blessed Sacrament. And then when I left, I got the word that the Easter Vigil Mass that night in English, the time had changed. And it was moved up to 8 o'clock instead of 10 o'clock. So I was able to go to the Easter Vigil Mass at 8 o'clock. And so I left there, went back to the roomy house where we were, and all the people in my group had all gotten gussied up. They were coming down the stairs to go to the Easter Vigil, and I said, it's already over. I said it was 8 o'clock instead of 10 o'clock, so they didn't get to go to the Easter Vigil.
You got the better one.
But, you know, just things happen, you know? But you just have to realize where you are and what's going on in your life, and just when you feel God trying to inspire you to do something, you should pay attention. You got to learn how to see with the eyes of your soul and hear with the eyes of ears of your soul. You know, because God's going to talk to you, but He's not going to sit there and shout at you. You know, not everybody has apparitions like the head in Fatima, right? But God still talks to you. He talks to you quietly with that little tiny voice. But if you got so much other stuff going on overshadows it, and you can't hear Him, you got to hear with your ears of your soul. And so that means you got to give time to Him. You got to sit there and listen to God. Let Him talk to you. Says, Father Benson says, the chief reason why the intellect fails always to analyze satisfactorily this supreme problem is because it was never intended to do so. Pain is one of those vast fundamental facts that must be scrutinized by the whole man, or not at all. If the problem of pain is to be solved at all, it must be solved by man, not by a part of him. That's kind of an odd thing to say. See, when we turn to Christ crucified, knowing who and what He is, we see the problem set before us in its most acute form. It is not a man who hangs there, however innocent. It is man without guilt. And it is not merely unfallen man who hangs there. It is the incarnate God who hangs there. See, man was never intended to suffer pain. When God created Adam and Eve, it was never their intent. They were never going to be scratched by thorns trying to pick blackberries or pick roses. You know, they were never going to die. And because of their disobedience, we encounter all those things as a result. So we have to put up with that. So that's why he says, you know, so man was never intended to do so. But by man's own actions, we now deal with it. I knew a sister back at St. William of York. We had a group of sisters there for a while. And she spent a lot of time dealing with the elderly, people that were struggling in particular, at homebound and stuff like that. And she said, it's a good thing we don't stay in the state we are when we're 25 for our whole life. Because if we're in that state when we were 25, when we're 95 and 100 years old, and it's time to move on, we wouldn't want to. But he said, if he gives you enough aches and pains and everything else, then you say, okay, enough of this. I'm ready to go, you know. So it was kind of a funny way to look at it, but I laughed when she said that. And I said, there's a lot of wisdom in that statement, you know. A lot of truth in that statement.
Same with Moses, with all the complaints.
Yeah, like a Moses today at the reading at Mass. You know, all these people grumbling, you know, kill me, you know, take me out of here. So it was kind of fun. It says, when we turn to Christ crucified, knowing who and what He is, We see the problem. We talked about that. He's in kindergarten. If we turn again to those other innocent sufferers, to the crippled child, the agonized mother, the darkened melancholic soul, if we isolate those sufferers from the rest of the human race, if we take them out of their context and regard them one by one, again, we are baffled. But if we meditate upon how it may be possible to see Christ in them, light begins to glimmer at once. So looking at the innocent sufferers, you know, and it comes in a variety of ways. A lot of people today are coming down with Alzheimer's. And so you look at them and you watch them go through that process. You know, my aunt died from Alzheimer's, my grandfather did, and my mother. And so if you have that in your family history, I kept looking to say, you know, am I going to get it? Well, I'm 82,
right?
And probably not. And I might have dodged that bullet, you know.
Yeah.
But when you look at somebody that goes through that, when I was looking at them, they go through a period of suffering when they realize it's happening to them. It's a very agonizing thing because they're afraid people are going to be laughing at them because they keep asking the same question every 2 minutes, all this kind of stuff. But then they get past that, and they get to a point where they're really not conscious of their suffering anymore. But their caregivers are the ones that are. Because my sister and her husband would not let them go into a nursing home. So they were both nurses, so they brought both my aunt and my mother to their home, different times, of course. And so they took care of them. Well, they were both working at the hospital, so they took alternate shifts so they could be there. But I asked my sister once, after my mother had died, and I said, you know, you and Tom probably won your sainthood taking care of Aunt B and Mom. And my sister said, yeah, it almost cost me everything because I almost had a nervous breakdown doing it, you know. My mother was particularly difficult because she was so physically capable for so long. My aunt was almost bedridden right away. But my mother was in phenomenal physical shape. I'd go visit them and I'd take her for walks. We'd drive down to New Orleans and visit, and I'd hold her hand and walk her around the yard and stuff. She could walk for miles. And my sister was always afraid she'd get out because she'd walk 10 feet and not know how to get back in the house. And
that happened to my mother and father. Mother had a lot of energy. She got out in the street. She'd walk down the street. My father couldn't catch her.
Oh.
She had to get in the car and run down the hill.
Yeah.
She
was like that. She was full of energy. And I remember sitting on the, I was in my sister's living room, and the living room went to the kitchen and then to the dining room, and then back around to the living room. It was kind of a big square. And I was sitting on the couch with her one day, and I said, let's take a little walk, you know. Because I wanted her, you know, keep herself up. So I walked her into the kitchen and around the dining room, back into the living room, and she said, oh, what a beautiful house. Whose house is this?
If it wasn't sad, it's really funny.
Yeah, I mean, she had just left that room, you know. And we were sitting on the couch, and Mary Beth was in the kitchen talking to my sister. And I was talking to my mother, and I was holding her hand, you know. And then she looked over in the kitchen, and she said, are you here with that woman?
Yeah.
I said, yes. She, you better not hold my hand. She might get jealous.
Exactly.
You know, she was very serious, you know, but she was so afraid. She didn't want to offend anybody, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It was just so funny.
But
she was so cute about it, you know. And she'd go through these periods where she was lucid.
Mm-hmm.
And then you'd have a nice conversation, and boom, she was gone again.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like a light switch. Pew! And, but so the people that do that are the caretakers. You know, when he's talking about here, the innocent sufferers and all, those innocent sufferers are not just the people that are sick. It's sometimes the caretakers for those people. And we got to think about that too. So if you know somebody who's a caretaker for somebody who's got a serious illness like that, try to go out of your way to help them, you know. Maybe take a shift for them, you know, something like a couple of hours break or whatever. Because, I mean, that's a tough tough road to hoe. Somebody who's got a child that has special needs, sometimes they need help too. You know, so it's really tough. So Father Benson says that we see the church to be the body in which Christ dwells. Saul, Saul, why do you persecute me? Then we see in, as in the authority of the church, the authority of Christ, his sanctity in hers, his priesthood in her ministers. So in her pains, his Calvary. And the church is going through pains right now, right? These sufferers are extensions of himself crucified, just as his priests are his agents. That which he did on Calvary, he represents in the sacrifice of the Mass. He offers once more the same sacrifice, although in another mode, under the terms of the blood and tears of those who are united with him. What then is the value of a willing sacrifice? It solves practically and satisfactorily the whole problem of pain. The words, a willing sufferer, are merely a phrase to describe a soul who has solved it. He has somehow succeeded in doing that which the intellect alone could not enable him to do. He has risen to that high atmosphere in which Christ rendered his soul into his Father's hands, and thereby silenced, at least in himself, that question which tortures perpetually those of us who merely stand by and look on. And we say the same thing. You know, into your hands I offer my suffering. And then eventually into your hands I offer my soul when it's time. And we'll do our last slide on the sufferer. Father Benson says, how august and tremendous becomes the dignity of the suffering soul, who, seeing Christ within her, desires to unite her pain with his. We just talked about that. And we, looking upon them and seeing in them not merely separate human souls in agony, but souls in whom Christ is set forth, evidently crucified, learn one more lesson of the friendship of Christ, that he who in his glorious and mystical body demands our obedience, in his sacramental body our admiration, in his priest our reverence, in his saints our admiration, and for his dear sinners our forgiveness, asks too in those who are conformed to him outwardly as well as inwardly, who bear their pain solely because he bears it for them, for that which is the most sweet of all the emotions that go to make up friendship, our tenderness and compassion. So he wants us to have compassion for him as well as for our neighbor. When you look at Christ's suffering, some people say, well, it's no big deal because he rose from the dead. He's glorified now, right? No, you think he suffered because of my sins. So you look at that and you say, I have my friendship because when I suffer, that's part of his suffering. You know, and I'm offering that for somebody's conversion. Christine Gallagher, the mystic in Ireland, she was visiting New York one day. I think I mentioned this before. She was visiting in New York one day and said that every time a soul converts, it's because somebody suffered for that soul. So our sufferings for the redemption of mankind include those actions which cause their conversion. And it's our sufferings that help that person convert. Sometimes it's helping our own children convert if they're falling away and they have to come back. Yeah. So we'll stop here. We'll pick up next time. We'll see what we can do next. Christ, our friend, crucified. So we're going to talk about Christ next. Okay. Good. Christ, our friend, crucified. So we'll stop with this. I'll stop the share. Does anybody have anything they want to bring up before we stop for the day? Nope. Everybody done? Okay. We will see you same time, same station next time.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you, Jim.
Welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you. Bye bye.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you for coming, everybody.
Can I have one more?
Yeah, sure. You can.